The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin Resveratrol Omega. Temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains. Temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains. And you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. Good morning, glory, America. Bonjour, I, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. The war goes on in Gaza. At midnight, Hamas fired a volley. Midnight Israeli time. Hamas fired a volley of rockets into Israel. The IDF responded at 4 a.m., and further rockets came from Gaza at 6 a.m., and so I think it's safe to say it will continue for at least as long as Hamas continues to try and kill Israeli citizens. I don't see how any state can do other than that, and I don't expect Benjamin Netanyahu to do other than that. I did a study this morning of the reaction of President Obama and his team in 2014 to the Gaza war, and President Biden and his team to the Gaza war in 2021. And they're exactly the same at the same point in time. But over the next 10 days, see if President Biden doesn't follow President Obama into increased pressure on and demands for unilateral ceasefire on the part of Israel. And that followed a humanitarian loss in 2014 that was significant, but the Biden administration has not yet done that. They continue to stress Israel's right to defend itself, and I am pleased with that. We'll continue to follow the war. I hope to talk with former ambassador of the United States from Israel, Michael Oren, later this morning. We have a lot of show today. Let me do the rundown for you. Besides Israel, of course, the biggest story of yesterday is that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear an abortion case, one that challenges Roe v. Wade in the minds of most people, although the court narrowed the questions it was going to decide to whether or not any limits were allowed on abortion prior to 15 weeks. It arises from a Mississippi law that did just that. It banned most abortions after 15 weeks. This is from Adam Liptak in the New York Times. Supreme Court on Monday said it would hear a case from Mississippi that could undermine Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision that established a constitutional right to abortion. I really do wish we could find reporters who were willing to explain that Roe v. Wade was undermined by Planned Parenthood v. Casey two decades later, and it's not really Roe v. Wade, but that's shorthand for an abortion regime of laws and rules and rulings that very few people understand. The new case, according to Liptak, concerning a state law that bans abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy will give the court's new 6-3 majority its first opportunity to address the subject, and supporters of abortion rights reacted to the development with dismay. Alarm bells are ringing loudly about the threat to reproductive rights, said Nancy Northup, president of the Center for Reproductive Rights. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal also reports on it, but in the New York Times, a great sense of inspiration. Anti-abortion activists expressed optimism. This is the flip side. And the New York Times does not follow my rule. Call people what they wish to be called. Pro-choice activists are pro-choice activists, and pro-life activists are pro-life activists. But New York Times doesn't like pro-life activists, so they call them anti-abortion activists. Doesn't matter. We're all the same people. Anti-abortion activists across the country expressed optimism on Monday that they might be on the cusp of achieving a long-held goal of the movement, overturning Roe v. Wade, the 1973 court decision that extended federal protections for abortion. There's a great sense of inspiration across the country right now, said Mike Gunadakis, president of Ohio Right to Life. This is the best court we've had in my lifetime, and we hope and pray that this is the case to do it. In a statement, Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of Susan B. Anthony List, a national anti-abortion organization against pro-life, called the court's move, quote, a landmark opportunity to recognize the right of states to protect unborn children, noted that state legislatures have introduced hundreds of bills restricting abortion in this legislative session. So I am not a prophet nor the son of a prophet. It is the most originalist Supreme Court of my life. And so whether or not there are five or more justices willing to uphold the Mississippi law, and whether they do so narrowly by simply upholding the Mississippi law and moving Planned Parenthood v. Casey into the dustbin of history, or whether they will simply go back to the 1972 regime, that it is up to the states. And by the way, in California and New York, it's a constitutional right to secure an abortion. So it would not have a dramatic effect at all in many places. And I don't think it'll have that much of a dramatic effect in some places. A few places it might. But it would become a federalism issue again, as it was from 1789 to 1973. Supreme Court also handed a victory to oil and gas companies fighting a climate lawsuit yesterday. The city of Baltimore had sued in state court, which is a giveaway, 20 multinational oil and gas companies on the allegation that they contributed to climate change and misled the public. Now, Baltimore can't do anything right. And so the idea that Baltimore is somehow going to be at the vanguard of climate change, I think they're trying to shake down the oil and gas industry for money that they haven't got. And the court didn't dismiss the action. It just said that's a federal court suit. Highly technical Civ Pro question. But the good news for oil and gas is that they do not have to fight that battle in state court. Warner Media Discovery merger sets up rivals for big decisions, according to the Wall Street Journal. That means that Discovery is taking over Warner. And so seasoned broadcast executives are going to be running CNN and many other assets of Warner Brothers. And that is going to be a big shakeup, but not nearly as big as what was announced this morning, which is that well played, Mr. Bezos, Amazon is going to buy, well, they don't say, it's in talk to buy MGM. Now, MGM has all the Bond movies, so they can just run that on a constant loop over at Prime, and we'll all be very happy. Amazon in talks to buy MGM, the storied Hollywood company behind the James Bond series, and many other things, by the way. MGM has got quite the backlog of television and movie shows, and it's an extraordinary deal for Amazon for its Prime customers to continue to attract people around the world. Bond may be the best franchise to own. Some people would say Marvel, but I think it's probably Bond. There's also a story I would recommend to all you young investors out there who love Bitcoin and all the rest. It's in the Wall Street Journal, from Bitcoin to Dogecoin, what's driving cryptocurrencies rise and the challenges ahead. I often say if you do not understand something, do not buy it, do not invest in it, do not get near to it. And that's a first step for you people. I still think it's nuts, and it's gone up 700% in a year, and I still think it's nuts for young people to be buying Bitcoin. Buy a stock like Amazon or AT&T. And AT&T just got shellacked, right? They just made a lousy decision on Warner. But buy something you know and you use and can talk about. Don't buy Apple. The New York Times expose of Apple's collapse in China to the demands of that state's censorship. Where are the woke employees of Apple that now find themselves complicit in genocide? It is truly off-putting, repulsive, ethically, to be doing what they're doing in China, which is to store all the private data of all the people of China on servers that the government runs, thanks to Apple. Andrew Cuomo was paid $5.1 million for his COVID-19 memoir. $5.1 million for a COVID memoir that obscured the fact he sent thousands of senior citizens to their death. And in Chile, a left-leaning assembly has been elected to write a new constitution. Now, why do I bring this up? Because constitution writing is hard. We got very, very blessed in the United States when our framers in 1787 gathered in Philadelphia, the most Catherine Drinker book, Miracle in Philadelphia. It's truly an astonishing moment. And I know black Americans would say, no, it wasn't an astonishing moment. They didn't do away with slavery, but they put the United States on a course where slavery would be abolished. That might not have happened but for the Constitution. Indeed, I don't think it would have happened when it did happen but for the Constitution and the Civil War. But I think that writing a constitution is extraordinarily difficult, and a left-leaning assembly, I don't know. Meanwhile, Paul Begala was on CNN with Jake Tapper and said this about Israel, and I want Democrats who are listening this morning, and I know you're out there to listen. Cut number two.
I think it's real, and I think it's deeply problematic as an American first, not just a Democrat. I'm a very strong supporter of Israel myself. Of course, I served a president, Bill Clinton, who's a very strong supporter of Israel and who advanced the peace process. I think that's the way to do it. But you're right, there are young, there's a generational divide in the Democratic Party. Younger Democrats who I think have really never known Israel except in the persona of Benjamin Netanyahu. And Netanyahu took a huge gamble and insulted Barack Obama, insulted Joe Biden, and really cozied up to Trump. And older guys like me remember and maybe know more of the history of what a stalwart, terrific ally Israel is for America, no matter who the leader is. I mean, I still loved America when Donald Trump was a president. I still love Israel, even though I don't agree with Mr. Netanyahu. In fact, our viewers should know I went to Israel in 2015 and worked for the opposition against Bibi Netanyahu. But I think you're right. There's a generational divide where younger Democrats are much less supportive of Israel.
Yep, there is. And that means, America, take note. The Democratic Party is split far more deeply than the Republicans are over Liz Cheney, over Israel. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. David M. Drucker from the Washington Examiner joins me now. Good morning, David. How are you?
Thank you. Good morning. I'm great. Thanks.
I enjoyed your story about Republican voters and Trump, and it reveals that there are ambivalent feelings about the former president. What I don't understand is why pollsters, isn't it your problem, it's pollsters, why don't they just flat out ask Republicans, do you support the insurrection on January 6th? I think they'd get 0%, but they never just flat out ask that question so that people can distinguish between that and say, did media help Joe Biden? That's what I look for, but they continue to conflate things, and therefore I don't think we can get a good picture of what Republicans think about anything.
Well, I'm not going to necessarily argue the point. I know that Republican pollsters who do a lot of private polling and will be doing a lot of private focus groups, and they've started to do some, are asking a lot of these questions. And look, what you find with Republican voters, and I've had conversations with them, is some of them, you know, don't look at the insurrection as the insurrection. They just look at it as, you know, a crowd of people that got a little out of control. And by the way, there are probably some leftists mixed in that you sort of tricked them into it. So I think you are right. It is a great question to ask. I suspect we will start to have answers over time, because in my discussions, you know, with Republican pollsters yesterday for this story, you know, they were explaining that they're just getting started with trying to gather data to help them in 2022 and have a better understanding of where President Trump fits in the Republican ecosphere. And right now, where he fits, at the very least, is that Republican voters are glad he's influential. They like his agenda. They want him to be a part of the team for 2022. And after that, they just don't know if they want him to be the nominee again in 2024.
But if pollsters, and I agree with that, and by the way, your article lays that out. But if pollsters were to ask specific questions, for example, the Supreme Court has accepted review of Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Do you approve of President Trump's three Supreme Court appointments? They might get three quarters, 80, 90% approval. Of the Supreme Court appointments. But then if they were to ask, did the media put a finger on the scales, they'd probably get 80, 90% approval. I'm looking, by the way, at an October 28th story in the Washington Post. Honey Badger don't care. Former Vice President Joe Biden leads President Trump by 17 points in Wisconsin, according to a new Washington Post ABC poll out this morning. That's a stunning gap, less than 1 week from the election in one of the states Trump picked off in 2016 to pull off his surprise upset over Hillary Clinton. It could herald a more substantial win by Biden than some Democrats are afraid to say aloud but are whispering about. When people say that Donald Trump was jobbed or cheated, I think a lot of them are thinking about that, David, and not about voter fraud. I think they're thinking about stories like this.
Well, there are Republicans that think about stories like that. But I would counter that a lot of Republican voters agree with the president that the election was stolen, or at the very least that there were such a high number of irregularities caused by Democrats using the pandemic to manipulate the rules that it just wasn't fair, and that this goes beyond the unfair way the media set the narrative. And I think that's a lot more prevalent than maybe you might think. I've had a lot of conversations about this.
And, no, I agree with you. David, I think that's exactly right. I think a lot of when people say it was stolen, I don't think they mean fraud in the terms of changing electoral machines. I'll bet you that's below 5%. I think they think stolen in the way I think that the Chiefs stole the win from the Browns by a terrible call in the through the end zone fumble rule when an illegal hit was missed. That game was stolen from the Browns, all right, and they were jobbed. And I think a lot of people think the Pennsylvania rigmarole lost it for trying and stories like this. But that's why polling's got to get much more precise, or it will fuel the misapprehension that Republicans think the insurrection was good. We don't. Or that there was significant fraud, which we don't. I don't think a majority of us do.
Well, look, I just don't think that the way you're interpreting this is necessarily the majority opinion when you talk to grassroots Republicans. And I think they take to heart the president's claims of theft based on broad conspiracies of ballot dumps and changing of votes in machines much more seriously maybe than you might suspect.
You see, I don't think they do. I would love to see that poll.
Analogy, using your sport. Well, and look, I'm just kind of giving you my sense from reporting, and I agree with you that the polling would be helpful here. Polling we could trust. But look, I do think there's a difference. I mean, look, growing up a UCLA fan before instant replay, I mean, I lived 3 years of USC basically, you know, so-called stealing football games because of phantom calls. But it was a part of the human error of life at the end of the day, even though
USC also paid the refs. USC also would buy off the refs, David.
It always seemed like payola, and that's why as a UCLA fan, I'd wave dollar bills, you know, during the game, expecting it to happen.
Perfect.
But look, I didn't walk away from the season saying to myself, this was a fake season, and that there was, you know, there was conspiracy to make sure USC won, although part of me wanted to believe that.
That's a perfect analogy. That's a perfect analogy, because we all know because there are some people who believe that USC has just like bought the refs, like the SEC has bought the ESPN network. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined from Israel by Dr. Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States, former deputy minister in the Netanyahu last permanent government. He's also the author of a brand new novel, To All Who Call in Truth, which I am greatly enjoying, Michael. I got the audiobook. I have listened to about half of it. I'm up to the SAPs not doing an investigation into the squirrel incident, and I am just genuinely enjoying it. Well done. I'm sorry your book dropped in the middle of a war, though.
They seem to always do that, to tell you the truth. I don't know. Maybe someone's telling me something. Good to be with you, Hugh. We're in the middle of a major uptick in the fighting in the South. Very large barrages hitting the South this morning. People seriously injured. And, you know, there's much talk about an impending ceasefire, but I don't see any sign of it right now.
I wanted to ask you about two things, the ceasefire and the political situation in Israel. First, the ceasefire. President Biden, I went back and compared with President Obama, has followed exactly the construction that President Obama used in the last Gaza war of 2014. But in 10 days, President Obama went from Israel's right to defend itself to demanding a unilateral ceasefire. Do you expect the same thing from Team Biden?
Not demanding. And I'll tell you why. Two reasons. First of all, it was context. When Obama made that demand, Israel was operating on the ground. And I don't see any large-scale ground operation in the works right now. We haven't called up the requisite number of reservists. There hasn't been that type of buildup along the border that you need of strategically 15,000, 70,000 soldiers. I don't see that right now. So that's one. Two, what can I say? President Biden is not President Obama. America was in a different position globally back then to make that type of demand. America has withdrawn a lot from the Middle East, and that has it impacted its leverage. And so the means through which this administration can pressure Israel are not what they were 10 years ago.
I am also impressed by what I understand to be and appears to be an evolution in weaponry so that Israel, with using precision munitions that can go deep, is systematically destroying the so-called metro. Am I right about that?
Yes, you're right about that. And that has relieved some of the pressure on us to go in on the ground, because now you can do it from the air, with what soldiers had to do on the ground before, actually going, you know, ferreting into these holes and blowing them up, which was tremendously dangerous for a soldier. We lost a number of soldiers doing that. So, yes, that's a big improvement. I think that behind all this, and we can't lose sight of the big strategic picture here, and that is who is behind this? Behind this is the major backer of Hamas, the exclusive owner and operator of Islamic Jihad, which is Iran. And that's the same Iran with which this administration is engaged in negotiations to renew the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. And I think that, you know, while credit has to be given to this administration for standing by Israel and upholding our right to defend ourselves, I also question, you know, at the end of this, when we go back into that negotiation with the Iranians about the JCPOA, will the administration say, well, listen, Israel, we stood by you in your hour of need in Gaza. Now, why don't you stand down a little bit while we renew this nuclear deal?
So, Dr. Oren, you're a very sober judge of these things. So I just ask you, is Hamas reeling? That's an American term that I think applies to lots of wars. Is the enemy reeling?
Okay. Everything you know about war, everything you know about conflict, when it comes to Hamas, throw it out. Okay. That for them reeling, for them suffering loss to a very large extent is a good thing. Okay. It makes them look like heroes. It makes them look like they are suffering for the Palestinian cause. If Israel inflicts damage on civilians in Gaza, inadvertently, it's good for Hamas. I've spoken before on this program how Iron Dome is a double-edged sword. Yet it creates disproportionality. It enables Hamas to say, look at all how we're suffering while the Israelis aren't suffering hardly at all. So they get credit for firing rockets at us, but they also get credit when we shoot back at them. Everything you understand. It was very difficult for a year and a half. I was in charge of Gaza for the Israeli government, and it took me a long time to wrap my head around the fact that Hamas actually likes humanitarian disaster in Gaza. It likes keeping the Palestinian people with nothing to lose, keeping them dependent on Hamas. They're immensely cruel. They use hundreds of kids to dig these tunnels, and hundreds of kids are killed every year digging this tunnel. They don't care. All right? The international community doesn't care, but the Hamas doesn't care. Everything you know about pretty much about human beings you can throw out the window when you talk about Hamas.
Wow. That's really revealing. By the way, so is your Hadassah article on Israel at 100. I don't know when you wrote that. It's incredibly timely right now.
Unfortunately, yes. Unfortunately, yes. You know, I also live in Jaffa. We've had some violence there, street violence. I was always very proud to say that I lived with a mixed community, that we lived together, Jews and Arabs, in harmony. Some of that harmony was disrupted this week. It's important to note, though, that the area where there were disturbances were almost exclusively areas that were very poor, working class areas. A lot of unemployment, both among Arab and Jewish youth. And we have to address not only the ethnic issue, but also the economic issue. Now, it's very big. You know, Israel is an economic miracle, but only for part of the population that's involved in high tech. We have a very big social gap.
So now to the political question, Dr. Oren. I read the Jerusalem Post, the Times of Israel, and Ynet News. I can barely find a mention of what is going on in coalition negotiations, and I believe it's probably out of respect for those who are on the front line and in the bomb shelters and those who have been killed and those who have been injured. Nevertheless, there is a deadline approaching for the government either to be formed by the opposition or to pass to the Knesset. What is going on? Can you just expound on what you understand to be going on with the prime minister and his allies and foes?
Well, there's scuttlebutt. And lots of it. And there's conspiracy theories. The conspiracy theories that Netanyahu basically precipitated this crisis in order to foil the attempts of the anti-Bibi camp to form a coalition with the explicit or implicit support of the Arab parties. That became impossible once this fighting started. And today the Arab communities of Israel are having a general strike, so it makes it even more difficult. Now the recent scuttlebutt is that that Benjamin Netanyahu and Benny Gantz are secretly in cahoots to keep the current coalition in place, and that that Benny Gantz will become prime minister for 18 months, but in a kind of strange arrangement, Netanyahu will remain in Balfour, that's Israel's White House, and he will retain the status of a prime minister so that he can appear in court and his corruption trials as prime minister, because if he's not prime minister, he has to resign.
Now, that would require an update to the law, would it not? Because if you're not the prime minister, even if you're living at the prime minister's house, you don't have immunity.
Yeah, you'd have to get a tweak into the law. No question about that. That would be the glue that would cement this deal together. And I imagine that's a sine qua non for Netanyahu, because he's not about to resign.
And so what happens to Naftali Bennett in this? He was supposed to come back. I thought there would be, and you and I talked about the potential of a Netanyahu-Gantz coalition last week, but Bennett had leverage. Does he not have any leverage? Doesn't he just go back to the other team, the anti-Netanyahu team, and begin to get back to where they were before Hamas began the war?
Listen, right now he's the big loser. Bennett's the big loser because the people who voted for him because he was right-wing now know that in principle, at least, he was willing to sit with the Arab party. So he's not entirely right-wing. Other right-wing parties refuse to sit with the Arabs. So he's lost those voters. Those people who voted for him because he was anti-Netanyahu realized that there's a chance he would actually sit with Netanyahu. So he's lost those voters. So his political fortunes are not particularly high right now. And recent reports in Israel said that Netanyahu is actually retreating from the offer he had made earlier to Bennett to make him prime minister in a rotation. And now that's been downgraded because, you know, today, in contrast to, say, 2 days ago, Bennett's political fortunes are much less and his leverage is much less.
So when do we expect to get any kind of hard news as opposed to scuttlebutt about coalition negotiations? Will they all have to be postponed until after the war is over?
Yes, probably. And listen, the war may go on for another couple of days, but you know, and eventually, and the clock will not have run out on the coalition time period where you can make a coalition. But and then it's dependent, you know, on how long the Israeli memories are. You know, we're so used to these different wars. 2 weeks from now, people may not remember it to the same degree that they remember it right now. I'm looking at the pictures now. I'm in a television station now, about to go onto Israeli television. I'm looking at photos of Hamas rockets blowing up in civilian settlements. The headline now is two killed and two in mortal condition. Just now, just as just what I'm talking to you.
So let me close by this before you have your hit, Dr. Warren. Thank you for joining us. The Democratic Party is split, and the left of the Democratic Party, from Bernie Sanders to AOC, is condemning Israel, and some of them are calling it a racist state, et cetera, et cetera. Are you surprised and disappointed by the fracture in the Democratic Party?
Of course, I'm not surprised, but I'm certainly disappointed. And I think that you know, I see what began as Israel was sort of a dividing line between Republicans and Democrats. Now it's become a dividing line within the Democratic Party itself. You know, at the end of the day, you know, we have to do what we have to do to defend our citizens. And Bernie Sanders can write all the op-eds in the New York Times that he wants to, and Peter Beinart can write all the op-eds in the New York Times he wants to. Our people are being shot at. And right now, two are dead and two are seriously wounded. We're going to do whatever it takes to defend them.
And, on that note, that is well said.
Our duty.
Call us back whenever you can. It's great to talk to you. Be safe, Dr. Michael Oren from Israel this morning. I love getting up to date, but I don't love getting news like that. Two more dead in Israel, two more seriously injured in this morning's rocket attacks from Gaza into the state of Israel. I'm sure there are people also dead in Gaza. I'm sure. I'm not making light of that. I understand that. I grieve for those families. But a terrorist entity is attacking Israel around the clock and killing Israelis. Of course, the Israeli government is going to respond around the clock unless and until that threat is ended. If Hamas wants the war to end, they have to stop sending missiles at Israeli citizens and killing Israeli citizens. That is the beginning point, and I cannot believe Democrats who do not understand. In fact, I want to play Paul Begala again from Jake Tapper's show yesterday on CNN, cut number two.
I think it's real, and I think it's deeply problematic as an American first, not just a Democrat. I'm a very strong supporter of Israel myself. Of course, I served a president, Bill Clinton, who's a very strong supporter of Israel and who advanced the peace process. I think that's the way to do it. But you're right, there are young, there's a generational divide in the Democratic Party. Younger Democrats who I think have really never known Israel except in the persona of Benjamin Netanyahu. And Netanyahu took a huge gamble and insulted Barack Obama, insulted Joe Biden, and really cozied up to Trump. And older guys like me remember and maybe know more of the history of what a stalwart, terrific ally Israel is for America.
You know, I wanted to hear Paul repeat. The Democratic Party has a generation gap. They have an Israel gap. And if you are a supporter of Israel, you really can't trust the Democrats with power. You just can't. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. I am joined now on the interview with Hugh Hewitt by Matt Continetti. He is the resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I just got done talking to Michael Oren from Israel, and two Israelis are dead this morning. Two more are injured in the southern part. He was about to go do a hit. That's the chyron on the screen. I don't think this is going to be over anytime soon. What do you think?
I tend to agree. You know, if my rule is if it didn't end by the Friday prayers last week, it was going to extend at least another week. And so I do think that a few people have been surprised, I think, by the resilience of the Hamas rocket supply. They have sent thousands upon thousands of rockets into Israel at ranges we haven't really seen before. But they've been slowly been deteriorated. And so I think it will take the IDF at least a few more days.
Three other things Dr. Oren said I'd like your comment on. First, he is not surprised by the Democratic Party split with many people opposing Israel's self-defense. But he said, and it's close to a quote, Bernie Sanders can write as many op-eds in the New York Times as he wants. Peter Beinart can write as many op-eds in the New York Times what he wants. But Israel will defend itself. I think actually that is the majority opinion among Americans of both parties. Do you?
Yes, though the dynamics are changing in disturbing ways, Hugh. I think we have three forces at work here. We have the Biden administration, which so far has supported Israel's right to defend herself, even while just yesterday calling for a ceasefire. But notice they just said they support a ceasefire. They didn't demand one. So they still are giving Israel time. And you have the Congressional Party, which is increasingly divided, and the energy seems to be with the Squad. And the Squad is following in the footsteps of Jeremy Corbyn's Labor Party, which is to become so is anti-Israel that they border on anti-Semitism. That was bad for Jeremy Corbyn's Labor Party. Labor still hasn't recovered, and it would be bad for the Democratic Party to follow the Squad in this way. Then finally, the third force, Hugh, is the media, which to me has been the most ridiculous of all. I have been shocked at the anti-Israel content of the American media. I think it's worse than the 2014 war. And I think it's extremely one-sided in an anti-Israel direction. And so as you go from the Biden administration to the congressional Democrats, then to the mainstream media, you get more and more anti-Israel. Luckily, of those three groups, the one with the most power and influence is Biden, and he's still giving Israel an opportunity to defend herself.
Now, Matt Continetti, I went back and looked at the 2014 war. President Obama originally defended Israel's right to defend itself, and then 10 days later was calling for a unilateral ceasefire. Dr. Oren distinguishes the context there, citing America's withdrawal from the Middle East as having lost its leverage. I'm not sure that's correct, but it certainly may be true. Do you expect the same turn over the same period of time as we saw with Obama to happen with Biden?
Well, look, we're about a week in. The international pressure and the congressional pressure on the Biden administration has increased. I think they're doing baby steps, but you're absolutely right. You can see the change in their statements from last week, where it was basically no comment. Israel is doing what Israel has to do, to just the past 24 hours, where it is we support a ceasefire. If the operation continues into next week, then I do think that you would begin to see even stronger rhetoric from the Biden administration. The question is how long it will last. And I just don't know what the Israeli war cabinet is thinking here, just because they have definitely degraded Hamas's personnel, their rocket supply, and yet the attacks are continuing. And I think there is a desire for a blow to Hamas's infrastructure that will basically knock it out for at least another 7 years. We just don't know how long that will take.
We talked about the increase in the lethality of the Israeli precision munitions against the so-called Metro. I haven't seen any other reporting except that which is in the Jerusalem Post, the Times of Israel, and Ynet News. But it does seem as though they are wreaking havoc on the Metro. Is that your impression, Matt Continetti?
Oh, absolutely. I think everything we see is that the IDF is winning this conflict, as they tend to do. They're doing it in extraordinary technological ways, Hugh. I mean, not only the precision munitions, but look at Iron Dome. I mean, the success of Iron Dome, getting up to 90% of the thousands of rockets being fired into Israel, is just amazing. And I think it's a real negative judgment on all of the critics of missile defense here in the United States for the past 25 years. We can see missile defense technology at work in Israel today, and we need to continue to pursue it.
Now, Matt Continetti, talk to me a little bit about why the media is so anti-Israel. I mean, really, what's going on there? Because I agree with you, that is what is happening.
Yeah, I think a few things are happening. One is just the herd of independent minds has now decided that Israel is the bad guy, Netanyahu is the bad guy. For whatever reason, Hamas doesn't get, you know, its credit or due. I mean, which is just amazing, this continual inability to recognize Hamas for what it is, which is a criminal terrorist organization that has no concern for innocent life whatsoever. And you compare that to the IDF, which goes out of its way to prevent civilian casualties. Another thing is, you know, Hugh, I've been reminded of that comment by the deputy national security advisor under Obama, Ben Rhodes, who told the New York Times back in 2015, I believe, that the thing about the American media is they know nothing, that they're 20-year-olds, they get stuck into these jobs, don't pay well at the opening levels. They spend most of their time just aggregating other people's opinions, and they don't know what they're talking about. And so as I read a lot of the newsletters or the junior positions explaining what's happening, it's just, I think, ignorance is at work. Now, that doesn't explain people like Tom Friedman, you know, who's like giving a conspiracy theory today saying that, oh, actually, Hamas and Bibi, they're working together to keep him in power. I mean, that's just absurd. It doesn't explain people like Peter Beinart, who had an atrocious column last week saying that Israel won't understand until they have a disaster of their own. But I think for the broadest sense, when I read the news reports, and especially online, people who have no idea what's going on and who just kind of think, Israel is richer, more powerful, more technologically advanced. Hence, they must be the bad guy. And what an atrocious piece of reasoning that is.
Now, Matt, I've also had a very brief civil exchange with Liz Kosten of The New York Times. She's going to join me to talk about this at length, where I had commented. Oh, you can't hear me. I had commented that the media is left, an extension of the Democratic Party. She said, no, it's not. I don't know why this is believed to be the case. Am I right or is she right?
What is her position again, Hugh? I missed you there.
Her position is that I am overstating the media's bias, that she doesn't understand why the position of me and many like me is that the media, legacy media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the networks, PBS, etc., are left, and now function as an extension of the Democratic Party. She disputes that.
Well, she's wrong. I mean, you look at the networks, you look at the newspapers. In fact, many times the media is the dog and the Democratic Party is the tail. I think the Democratic Party is taking the cues from the media about what they should be concerned about, what they should be interested in, advocating. This is a problem for the Democratic Party. I mean, you see You see now the House, it's a very narrow majority for the Democrats. It depends on these swing districts, Hugh. If they are to follow the cues from the media and from the squad on the issue of Israel, I think it would be a disaster for them, not only in the short term and their credibility in national security, but also going into the midterm election, because it just shows that they are kowtowing to the left, you know. And the same goes for Biden. He has enough problems on his hands. Creating daylight between the U.S. and Israel would just increase them, I think.
So one more pass over this question. You answered it first by saying they don't know anything, they're ignorant. But why is there systemic left-wing bias in the elite media? And I mean the Manhattan Beltway media. I'm not talking about papers out in Cleveland or papers in Alabama. I'm talking about the Manhattan Beltway quarter. Why does that systemic bias exist? How deep is it? And what do they do about it?
Well, I think it's the same reason there's bias in the universities. It's all about hiring. It's all about hiring. And especially in the last 10 years, Hugh, you've seen editorial management and leadership become more politicized, more left-wing, and hence they're only hiring and promoting people with their views. So the same kind of pathologies we see in the university of cancel culture, of kind of rigging the system to benefit the tenured employees, is at work, I think, in a lot of the media. And so that's why I think that the bias has become entrenched. Also, one other thing, you know, there's a big audience for left-wing propaganda. And there are a lot of clicks involved and a lot of people who want to buy it and read it. And I think that's also incentivizing this completely one-sided coverage of events like what's happening in Israel.
I tell people I had the lowest rated show in the history of MSNBC. But it was a noble effort by Andrew Lack to try and put a conservative voice into a blue universe. And it failed because they will not watch. And by the way, that's true about the right wing, too. So we have monetized and segregated audiences. I am just very worried that that ends up with no news at all. And two complete factories of affirmation, confirmation bias.
Oh, absolutely. I think we see that today. I mean, there's some hope now with the Substack, the newsletter revolution. There are people who want to have a more detached or a more factual view. They're having new media to look at. But there's been an incredible amount of disinformation on this conflict when you go online and you look at social media. And, of course, bad actors are at work manipulating that misinformation and spreading it. And so it's important to have places where you can go to see the news. I'm urging people to go to Israeli media. If you go to the Jerusalem Post, if you go to the Times of Israel, you get a much better account of what is happening. And by the way, not, you know, rah-rah Netanyahu either. They're going to say what is going on, what are we doing, what is the status. And so this is the comparison between the American media on this and the Israeli media. It has been, I think, just a disaster for the U.S. media. In many ways, American media is resembling, say, the BBC, which is long-running, you know, anti-Zionist, borderline anti-Semitic coverage of the Middle East. That's a very dangerous and bad place to go for the United States media. But I can only say, luckily, we have, you know, the internet, so we can go and see what's really happening if we go to these Israeli websites.
Last question, Matt. Ynet News, I would also add to those two, the Jerusalem Post, Times of Israel, and Ynet News. These are three English-speaking and free sources for people, and it is very balanced. Prime Minister Netanyahu has lived to survived to fight another day in coalition. Dr. Oren said Benny Gantz is now the scuttlebutt, going to have a deal with Netanyahu that preserves his immunity against trial. What do you hear in Washington, D.C. about what is going to happen in Israeli politics post the war?
Oh, I mean, what I hear is utter confusion. I mean, which is basically the state of Washington's attitude toward Israeli politics for the past several years. I mean, we're now, you know, four elections in. We have these continuing coalition politics in Israel. I'll say this. One consequence of this war was to scuttle the talks that were going to include an Arab Islamist party, Ram, in a coalition, an anti-Netanyahu coalition. That ended that. And what I think, when I look at what's happening in Israel today, I think it's not about the United States. It's not even about Netanyahu. It's about intra-Arab Palestinian politics. That is, Hamas used an opportunity. given to them by Abbas, the Palestinian Authority leader, when he canceled the parliamentary elections. They wanted to scuttle any attempt at integration of the Arab-Israeli minority with the majority population. And they're using this in a bid for leadership of the Palestinian cause and kind of leadership for the Arab nationalist cause, whatever remains of it. So when I look at this, I see this as internal Palestinian politics. And it's also, though, it's an opportunity now for Israel to really degrade Hamas's capability. And if they're able to show the world that Hamas's actions do not pay, then I think we'll have another respite. And it could be good for Netanyahu. But the thing is, when people talk only about Netanyahu, Hugh, they don't realize the national security issue unifies all Israelis. There is no difference on national security between Netanyahu or Gantz or whoever is going to replace him. So this is something to keep in mind. And all the American left who thinks, oh, get rid of Netanyahu and peace will flow, they're absolutely wrong.
They are. Matt Contineni of the American Enterprise Institute, you are always a great guest. Thank you for joining me this morning. Check in with you soon. Follow him on Twitter at Contineti. I'm joined now by Fred Barnes, columnist at large of the Washington Examiner, longtime observer of all things in D.C. Good morning, Fred.
Hi, how are you, Hugh?
Good. I just got done talking to Matt Contineti, who followed a conversation with Michael Oren about the American media's coverage of the Israeli Hamas war. Yep. What do you make of that coverage?
I think it's what we would have expected. It's an entirely anti-Israel coverage. It's entirely in favor of not that they don't say, well, we're backing the position of the Iranians, but in fact, that's what they're doing. They present pretend like Hamas is not a terrorist group. Hamas, of course, is the group that runs the Gaza Strip. And is rocketing homes and other places in Israel. They pretend like it's just it's kind of an extreme group, but not that it's a long time terrorist group. They're pretending something's going on there that is not going on, and namely that somehow Israel's responsible for all the deaths there and all the violence, when it's just the opposite that's true.
Now, Fred, you've been covering Washington for 40 years, and so I'm wondering, media, has it gone left, left, left? Is it now an extension of the Democratic Party, or is it as it was 40 years ago?
No, I think it's an extension of not just the Democratic Party. I mean, the Democratic Party is still divided on many issues, although the majority and the influential wing of the Democratic Party is the progressive element, the one that wants to create more government and so on. We know how far left they are, and that's the one that has the influence right now. It is a much bigger influence than the centrist Democrats. Now, and what I finally decided is that Trump, of course, is accused of having a big lie about a stolen election in 2020. Biden has a big lie, and that is what kind of a president he would be ideologically and otherwise. The big lie is that he would be a centrist, that he would unite the parties, and he would be someone who Americans would like. Anything, he would not be, no mention of anything about the left wing of the party. Now, what happened instantly? All of that that he had said, even in his original address, his inauguration address, turned out to be utterly untrue. It was a big lie. And what's happening is the party is run by the far left. And Biden himself is run by the far left of the Democratic Party.
Now, I want to go back to the media, though, Fred. Has it become significantly more left-wing in the last 10 years? Significantly more?
Definitely so. Think about how Barack Obama acted as president. Did he act like a far left president who was being cheered on and backed by the mainstream media? No, he was backed by them, but he wasn't overdoing it. His big issue was health care. He did in his second term negotiate what I think is a terrible deal with Iran, but he was not a far left president, and the media wasn't there. It is there now, and one of the reasons is because of the weakness of Biden. You know, Biden is, as I've written and said, has never had a fresh idea of his own. He only gets ideas from others in the Democratic Party, and right now he's getting them from the progressive left wing of the party.
So, Fred, I asked this of Matt. I want to hear your answer as well. Why has the media gone over the left edge of the cliff?
Well, a lot of them are there anyway, and they have just gotten in a controlling position in the Democratic Party, somewhat to my surprise. I really wasn't expecting it, but you do have to remember that Biden is someone who is very very impressionable. He doesn't have any ideas of his own. He gets somebody. And look who he promoted. I guess the biggest clue, the earliest clue about the direction Biden was going to go was who he was hiring to be in his cabinet, to be in his White House, and they were all coming from the left wing of the Democratic Party. Certainly to my surprise, maybe to yours as well, Hugh.
Well, people won't believe this, but Fred Barnes was the lead reporter for the New Republic in the 80s, and that was considered to be the preeminent journal of the time, fair and balanced, completely objective, and a reliable source of news about what was going on in the White House. And I don't know what elite media, legacy media, I call it, expects to do for audience, Fred. I think their numbers are crashing because they have decided to super serve a very small percentage of Americans. By the way, Fox does the same thing. I believe that both ends of the spectrum now want 100% of the 3%, the 3% on the far left, the 3% on the far right. And Fox wants the 3% on the far right. And CNN, MSNBC want 3% on the far left, as does the New York Times and most of the Washington Post. It's not a sustainable business model.
And, well, I don't think it is either. But the difference is the print media and also the major television media were not there. I mean, look, Fox has been very conservative for almost since its beginning in 1995-96. But the Washington Post and the New York Times, while always liberal, were not there. But they are now, extremely liberal. Therefore, I mean, on everything you name the issue, and they're there, whether it's critical race theory or foreign policy, or whether the U.S. should have gotten out of Afghanistan, which I think was a critical error by Biden, and on and on and on. That's where they are now. They have moved to the left, and we see some of these things, which I chuckle at, but they haven't been good for America, where a seemingly small influential groups, well, maybe not small, but influential groups in the newsrooms of big newspapers and important national television networks have their say. They can get people fired and certainly change the way things are covered. And it's now to the far left. I never expected it to happen now. I've known Biden for a long time. And when he's talking about unity and everything in that speech, and he has always been a centrist Democrat waiting around to see what the party wanted, and he'd be for it. But a far-left progressive, that's just not who Biden has been. That's not who he campaigned on. And that's where we get the big lie. I mean, he lied that he would be somebody that from the beginning of his administration he has not been.
So my last question, Fred Barnes, is about America and Israel. I actually believe support in the United States has remained consistently off the charts in favor of Israel, a democratic free state, a republic that is not an apartheid state. I think the media is completely out of step with the audience. Do you agree with me that America remains overwhelmingly supportive of Israel?
I do at the moment. Whether it will stay that way with the media, wanting wanting to prove that Israel bombed a building in Gaza, where some of the media branches are and so on. If the media keeps it up, and I expect it to, this far left position that Israel is a combatant that's responsible for the deaths and the bombings and started it all and so on, it will change. I mean, Israel, I don't think Israel will become heavily unpopular, but the popularity it has now will begin to fade, I think.
You know, Fred, either it will change or the audience will melt away. I think it's going to be the latter. I think people are not buying what legacy media, elite media is selling. I really don't. I think they're killing their audience.
Right.
Fred, good to talk to you. Follow him at Fred Barnes. Read him in the Washington Examiner whenever he deigns to give us a column. He's semi-retired now, so he's a man of leisure, man of letters, puttering around his library and reading UVA stories and that sort of stuff. But come back early and often, Fred. Good to talk to you. Don't go anywhere, America, except over to HughHewitt.com. We are providing scholarship for the children of prisoners. The sons and daughters of men and women in prison need to go to camp, just like your kids need to go to camp. It costs $200 that those families don't have to send a kid to an Angel Tree Prison Fellowship camp this summer. They are open. They are taking children. Please be generous. Go to HughHewitt.com. Wait for it to load at the very top. You'll see the Angel Tree banner. Whether you can give $20 or $200 or $2,000 or $20,000, these kids need to get to camp. Please be as generous as possible. The banner is at HughHewitt.com. Come right back on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by United States Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. Senator, welcome. Earlier today, I played your remarks on the floor of the Senate yesterday about Israel and the AP. I don't imagine the media much like that, but I compliment you on calling these issues out.
Well, I'm glad your listeners got to hear it this morning, Hugh. The AP has some uncomfortable questions they need to answer. Everyone probably knows by now that Israel struck a building in Gaza that Hamas intelligence was using to target Israeli citizens. That building also happened to house the AP and other news media. Israel, as is its practice, gave the innocent civilians in the building advance warning so they could evacuate, which of course means that Hamas gets advance warning and terrorists regrettably get away. But that's because Israel respects human life, unlike Hamas. The AP and other reporters got up in high moral dudgeon about this fact. But one has to ask, like, did the AP not know who their neighbors were? I mean, there's evidence out there, Q, from videos to former AP reporters saying that they've known for years they were sharing office building with Hamas, basically allowing themselves to be used as human shields, all the while suppressing what Hamas was doing in that building, firing rockets away or trying to terrorize reporters. So I think it's incumbent upon AP leadership to explain exactly how long they have known that they were sharing an office with a U.S. designated terrorist organization.
Now, you also posed on Twitter a very penetrating question. Would AP share a building with Al-Qaeda? And I'd like you to make the point. Al-Qaeda and Hamas are, in the eyes of the United States government, the same thing, designated terrorist organizations.
Yeah, there is no difference between Al-Qaeda and Hamas to radical Sunni Islamic terrorist organizations. They are both designated by the United States as terrorist organizations. Would the AP or would any of their defenders in this controversy be willing to share office space with Al-Qaeda? If they learned that Al-Qaeda was upstairs or down the hall, would they stay in that office space? Would they go to the authorities and report on what they had discovered? I think these are some of the uncomfortable questions that the AP leadership needs to answer, Hugh.
Now, I also talked with Matt Continetti of AEI and Fred Barnes of the Washington Examiner this morning about the media's coverage of the Israeli self-defense underway and still underway. Regrettably, when I was talking with Dr. Oren, two more Israeli citizens were killed this morning, two more seriously injured in missile attacks. But it does seem to me that the American media has gone significantly anti-Israel, far more than it's ever been before. Do you see that, Senator Cotton?
Unfortunately, Hugh, the American media, of course, usually reflects the opinion of the elite left in this country. And the left in this country has become increasingly anti-Israel in recent years. You see that from elected Democrats who are calling Israel an apartheid state and demanding that we cut off our support to Israel, or that Israel's leaders be charged for war crimes. Those opinions marinated in campus seminar rooms and marches out in our streets are reflected by their peers and former classmates and their friends in the American media. And that's why you get news media asking, how could this happen? Why did this war start now? Well, it started because Hamas started firing hundreds of rockets and missiles into heavily populated cities in Israel. It's pretty simple. And it will end when Hamas's war machine is defeated.
Matt Condon made an interesting point, Senator, which I had not heard made before, which is this is also very much about an internal Palestinian and Arab power struggle, about who is going to lead the Palestinian struggle, that Hamas wishes to use this attack as an effort to derail the coalition government that appeared to include Ra'am, an Islamist party in Israel that was on the verge of taking power from Netanyahu, and to further discredit the Palestinian Authority. Have you heard that theory? Do you put much credit to it?
Yeah, so that's possible, Hugh. It's also possible that it's related to internal Palestinian politics with the prospect of an election coming up this year. You know, as the saying goes, Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the PA, is now in the, I think, 16th year of his four-year term from the last time they had an election. But irrespective of those considerations, whether there's some effort by Hamas to interfere in Israeli politics or to redirect Palestinian politics, of course, there is never a justification for the use of terror to achieve political ends, much less the use of terror in the form of thousands and rockets and missiles being fired indiscriminately at innocent civilians.
Now, Senator, you're one of the very few members of Congress I can ask this of. Since you led platoons in Iraq during the height of the surge, to what extent can militaries guard against collateral damage? And I think that's a terrible term, against civilians dying. And I know that the American military and the Israeli military take extraordinary measures to do just that. But how much does the United States and do you think Israel put into that effort?
Where the two of the most disciplined and moral militaries in the world, if anything, though, the Israeli Defense Forces go the extra mile to ensure that there is as little civilian casualties on the battlefield as possible. The example I gave you to start is a good one. You know, they could have just pancaked that building that Hamas was using for intelligence purposes, irrespective of civilians inside of it. I mean, it's a legitimate military target, and the people responsible for the civilian casualties would have been Hamas. But they didn't do that. They called in advance. They told the innocent civilians, clear out now. And what did that mean? It meant all those Hamas intelligence personnel were able to escape alive, and today they're once again targeting Jews for death inside of Israel. Now,
so go ahead.
Israel does that because they respect and esteem human life, unlike Hamas.
And so in minimizing civilian casualties, they do pay a cost because those terrorists live to fight another day. The second story this week is that some in the media were upset that Israel may have misled the media as to a ground invasion. Now, I was actually paying very close attention to the statements that came out of Israel, and they said attacking from the ground, which is so different from a ground invasion. I immediately, my antenna were up that something odd was going on. It was, in fact, an effort to trick Hamas into going into the tunnels or coming out of the tunnels or both, depending on which units were involved. Did you see that outrage, and what did you make of it?
Well, Hugh, you're not going to get me to cry crocodile tears if a bunch of Hamas terrorists were duped by military subterfuge, deception, or camouflage, which is as old as warfare itself. You're right, though, that the Israeli military, to my knowledge, was very precise in the terminology it used. It can't be held responsible if ill-informed Western reporters didn't read carefully enough.
Now, a couple of last questions about the Israeli military. In the 7 years since 2014, it appears that they have developed a new generation of weapons which can penetrate into the so-called metro. Is that your understanding without giving away classified sources? Are they better at this now, blowing up tunnels, than they were in 2014?
Hugh, when you phrase it that way, yes. Of course, after 7 years of recognizing the threat that these Hamas terror tunnels pose, Israel has invested significantly in the ability to destroy those tunnels.
Do we have that ability in the United States, the same kind of technology?
Well, does it pose the same threat to us, Hugh, that it does to Israel because of our geographic position? But let me simply say that the United States and Israel have a very close military working relationship, something that I've worked to advance in my time in the Armed Services Committee, and we share a lot of technology.
Now, let me close by asking you to contrast and compare. Senator Bernie Sanders and others in the Democratic Party have been completely outraged with Israel, and yet our Arab allies like the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and others, including Saudi Arabia, have been very muted. In fact, I don't think they've condemned Israel at all compared to Hamas. I think they're more worried about Hamas. So is it unusual to see Bernie Sanders more critical than Arab allies of the actions of Israel?
Regrettably, that's become increasingly normal, Hugh. You're right that a lot of these Arab nations have their own threats from radical Islamic extremist groups like Hamas and Al-Qaeda. Also, let's not forget who Hamas's main patron is, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the chief threat also to countries like Saudi Arabia and to the United Arab Emirates. So Iran is also up to its usual tricks because the Biden administration in Vienna has been basically begging the Ayatollahs to come back into the Iran nuclear deal, which means the lifting of sanctions and hundreds of billions of dollars pouring to Tehran, which will immediately go back to Hamas and to Hezbollah in the forms of rockets and missiles aimed at Israeli citizens.
You're right. On that note, Senator Tom Cotton, thank you for joining me this morning. Follow him on Twitter at Sen Tom Cotton. Sen Tom Cotton.